everyone. It's wonderful to see everybody today. Hope everybody had a wonderful Passover, and then last night I hope that everybody had a wonderful night to be. Now we're keeping the first day of unleavened bread. Uh-oh, I messed something up. There we go. Okay. You know what makes this festival different from all the other ones? Well, actually, there's probably a lot of things. But what I'm specifically focusing on is that we're supposed to put out all of our leavened bread, leavened items, and we're supposed to partake of unleavened bread. That's the name, Days of Unleavened Bread. Let's turn back quickly to Leviticus 23, read the command. Leviticus 23, and we'll start in verse 4. And it says, "These are the feasts of the Lord, holy convocations, which you shall proclaim at their appointed times. On the 14th day of the first month at twilight is the Lord's Passover. And on the 15th day of the same month is the feast of unleavened bread to the Lord. 7 days you must eat unleavened bread." So God commands us to keep 7 days where we eat no leavened bread at all. We're supposed to eat unleavened bread. If we turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 16, elaborates a little bit more. Deuteronomy chapter 16, and we're going to read verses 3 and 4. It says, "You shall eat no leavened bread with it. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread with it. That is the bread of affliction, for you came out of the land of Egypt in haste, that you may remember the day in which you came out of the land of Egypt all the days of your life. And no leaven shall be seen among you in all your territory for 7 days, nor shall any of the meat which you sacrifice the first day at twilight remain until the morning." You know, notice also that at least in this original instruction God gave to the Israelites for doing this was a reminder that when they left Egypt, they did it in haste. That's why they were eating the unleavened bread. It was something that happened quickly, that he did powerfully. It was miracles that did this. You know, we also consider this was a time that they didn't have yeast packs. You know, in order to leaven your bread at this time, you let it sit out in the air, because the air is full of yeast. And if you let it sit out there long enough, that air, the yeast in the air, is going to interact with that dough, and it'll leaven it. It'll cause it to become a leavened lump, and it'll cause the bread to rise. But however, because Israel left Egypt in such haste, they took along bread that had not had enough time to become leavened. Now, Jesus, when he came down to earth, was obviously very aware of all of this. You know, he was the God of the Old Testament. He set all this up. He's the one that gave them the instructions. He was the God that was with Israel back when all of the Exodus occurred. So I found a place where Jesus is getting ready for the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread, and he makes some interesting remarks. And we normally read these during the Passover, but we're going to focus on it a little bit longer, the full text of it. So I want you to turn back to John chapter 6. We're going to read a good bit of this, because I think it teaches us something. We're going to start in verse 1, John chapter 6. It says, "After these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. And then a great multitude followed him, because they saw his signs, which he performed on those who were diseased. And Jesus went up on a mountain, and there he sat with his disciples. Now the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near." You know, please take note that this event is occurring just before the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread. And Jesus was obviously thinking about that, as we'll see. He gets into it a little bit. And also notice that this is a great crowd of people. We're going to find out it's about 5,000 people. It's a great crowd that was specifically following him because they had seen the signs that he had been performing. They had seen him performing miracles, healing people. They were amazed. They were following him. They had some level of indication that he was an important individual. So keep that in mind as we read the rest of this account. Start going back to verse 5, it says, "Then Jesus lifted up his eyes, and seeing a great multitude coming toward him, he said to Philip, 'Where shall we buy bread that these may eat?' But this he said to test him, for he himself knew what he would do." He had this all planned out. This is not an accident that occurs. This is not a lack of planning on Jesus' part. Jesus knows exactly what he intends to do here. And Philip answered him, "You know, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may have a little bit." Now, 200 denarii, a denarii was what you would get paid if you worked a day. So in today's money, that would probably be like $100. So, you know, he's saying that $20,000 isn't enough to buy all the bread that they need. And one of the other disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "You know, there's a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fish. But what are they among so many?" And then Jesus said, "You know, make the people sit down." Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down in number about 5,000. And Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to the disciples, and the disciples to those who were sitting down, and likewise of the fish, as much as they wanted. So when they were filled, he said to the disciples, "Gather up the fragments that remain so that nothing is lost." Therefore they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with the fragments of the 5 barley loaves which were left over by those who had eaten. Then those men, when they had seen the sign that Jesus did, said, "This is truly the prophet who is to come into the world." You know, it seems at this point that they are fully believing, fully convicted that Jesus is the prophet prophesied by Moses. And yet we're going to read a little bit further and how things change. You know, feeding 5,000 people with 5 loaves, I don't care how big those loaves are, but the indication is they were pretty small. You know, when they take up the 12 fragments, they probably wouldn't have even been able to fit 12 fragments. I wouldn't be able to fit, you know, he'd probably fit this meal into one basket. So when they take it up, it was a great miracle. I would have loved to know how it looked. I've often thought about that. Like, how did it look? How did it multiply like it did? That's something that maybe someday we'll get to find out. You know, could the people actually see the bread and the fish, you know, keep multiplying when he put it out to be distributed? Whatever it was, the people saw the miracle, and they were greatly impressed. They were so impressed that it says a little bit later that Jesus had to withdraw because the people intended to try to take Jesus by force at this point and make him a king. You know, that was how convicted they were here. But the story doesn't end here. The story continues. We're gonna drop down to verse 22, and we're going to keep reading. It says, "So the Jews..." Oh, wait. I went to chapter 8. We want to stay in chapter 6. Sorry. "So on the following day..." So a day immediately following this miracle, "when the people were standing on the other side of the sea, saw that there was no other boat there except the one which his disciples had entered, and that Jesus had not entered the boat with his disciples, but his disciples had gone away alone." So the people were standing there. They stayed overnight, you know, right where they were at. And they were looking for Jesus the next day. What they did not know is that he walked across the water and was over in Capernaum. But they find it out soon. In verse 23, it says, "However, other boats came from Tiberias, near the place where they ate bread after the Lord had given thanks. And when the people therefore saw that Jesus was not there, nor his disciples, they also got into boats and came to Capernaum to seek Jesus. And when they found him on the other side, they said to him, 'Rabbi, when did you come here?'" So Jesus and his disciples, you know, they leave the place And the crowd goes looking for him, and they find him at Capernaum, and they ask him where he got there, and they seem very enthusiastic. They seem very energetic. But Jesus knows what they're really thinking. So he responds in verse 26, and it says, Jesus answered them and said, "Most assuredly, I say to you, you seek me not because you saw the signs, but because you ate the loaves and were filled." He says, "Do not labor for the food which perishes, for the food which endures to everlasting life, but for the food which endures to everlasting life, which the Son of Man will give you, because God the Father has sent his seal on him." Then they said to him, "What shall we do that we may work the works of God?" And Jesus answered and said to them, "This is the work of God, that you believe in him who he sent." So Jesus kind of calls them out in a very remarkable way. He says, "You know, you don't believe the miracles. I know why you're here. You're here because you ate that bread and you were filled. That's why you're here. But what you really need to do," he's saying, "is you need to believe in me." Now, it would seem from everything that we've read up to this point that they did believe in him. They were following him to the wilderness area where they had no food in the first place because they had seen some signs. They had just seen the sign of the bread being multiplied. They wanted to make him a king. They had called him the prophet of Moses. It would appear that they believed in him. But obviously Jesus is saying that they don't. And he's saying, you know, you're really striving after this bread. You're not striving after food which endures to everlasting life. We're going to continue reading, verse 30. He said, "Then they said to him," you know, he said, "You need to believe in me." So they respond, and they said to him, "Well, what sign will you perform then, that we may see it and believe you? What work will you do? Our fathers ate the manna in the desert, as it is written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat." You know, they basically straight up say, "You know, we don't believe you. Prove it to us. We've seen all these other signs, but still prove it to us." Specifically, they're saying, "If you can give us manna from heaven, then we'll believe." Now, I find that very ironic. And Jesus, I think, knew exactly what was going to be said there because he has the perfect response for that. But manna from heaven, that's what they wanted. They were still focused on the bread. They were still focused on their belly. Jesus was 100% correct. So that's what they were saying. And he responds back to them. And he says, "Most assuredly, I say to you, Moses did not give you the bread from heaven, but my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world." And then they said to him, "Lord, give us this bread always." You know, Jesus is telling them, he's correcting them, because they had this image in their mind that Moses had given them manna. No, Jesus is saying, "Moses didn't give it to you. My Father gave you the manna, and now he's giving you the true bread of heaven." And they said, "Give us it." What they don't seem to understand is this true bread of heaven was Jesus, and he is offering it, freely offering it, not charging anything for it. But the people, they're expecting him to give something literal at this point, to eat, that will blow their minds. They want that manna, whatever they imagine it to have tasted like. So they continue, and Jesus said to them in verse 35, "I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst. But I said to you that you have seen me, and yet do not believe. All that the Father gives me will come to me, and the one who comes to me I will by no means cast out. For I have come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me." This is the will of the Father who sent me, that of all he has given me I should lose nothing, but should raise it up at the last day. And this is the will of him who sent me, that everyone who sees the Son and believes in him may have everlasting life, and I will raise him up at the last day. Jesus is telling the people that he is the bread of life, and by doing so, he is claiming divinity. And the people pick up on that very clearly. You know, we've heard this. We've partaken of the symbols at Passover of unleavened bread. And Jesus is making the comparison here to the manna that was given to Israel as being a foreshadow of the true bread of heaven that he was representing physically in his presence, spiritually, in who he was. Now the people were willing to believe him as a great prophet. They couldn't deny that. They saw him heal people. They saw him turn 5 loaves of bread into enough food to feed 5,000 people. However, we'll see that his claim to be from heaven didn't go over so well. Read verse 41, it says, "But the Jews then murmured against him because he said, 'I am the bread of heaven, which came down from heaven.' And they said, 'Isn't this Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? No, he's from Nazareth. He's not from heaven. How is it then that he says, "I have come down from heaven"?'" You know, they could not accept that Jesus was from heaven. They knew his relatives. They could touch him. Therefore, they could not accept that he was from heaven. In some ways, I think it might actually be easier for us now to believe that he was from heaven than those that were physically there. If somebody came down here today and said that they were, if Jesus came down and said that he was Jesus, if he made signs, did the signs, maybe we'd believe him. But at that time, they didn't. But continuing on. "Jesus therefore answered and said to them, 'Do not murmur among yourselves. No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him up at the last day. It is written in the prophets, and they shall all be taught by God. Therefore, everyone who has heard and learned from the Father comes to me. Not that anyone has seen the Father except he who is from God. He has seen the Father. Most assuredly, I say to you, he who believes in me has everlasting life. I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and are dead. This is the bread which comes down from heaven, that one may eat of it and not die. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I shall give is my flesh, which I shall give for the life of the world.'" Now Jesus starts to really lay out who he really is, and why we must believe in him. And they don't understand what he means when he says that that his flesh is the bread. They're still thinking in very literal terms. But he's making very clear here that he is truly the only source of life. So if we continue on, it says, "The Jews therefore quarreled among themselves, saying, 'How can this man give us his flesh to eat?'" They're thinking, we're not cannibals. It's against the commandments to eat flesh from an unclean source. They're not understanding. And then Jesus said to them, "Most assuredly, I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up the last day. For my flesh is food indeed, and my blood is drink indeed. He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood abides in me, and I in him. As the living Father sent me, and I live because of the Father, so he who feeds on me will live because of me. This is the bread which came down from heaven, not as your fathers ate the manna and are dead. He who eats this bread will live forever.' These things he said in the synagogue as he taught in Capernaum, and therefore many of his disciples when they heard this, said, "This is a hard saying. Who can understand it?" Many of the disciples who followed him, who believed that he was a great prophet, after this, they were done. They said, "This can't be right. We can't have to eat somebody's flesh. We can't drink somebody's blood. That's against the law. We know that." Now, we know from the Passover that unless Jesus is in us, unless we partake of the bread and the wine and have him live in us, that we have no life. We understand that because he was speaking about spiritual things. Even his disciples don't understand that at this point. He asked them, "Does it offend you?" And they pretty much said, "Well, you know, we might not understand it, but nobody else is doing what you're doing." But he also points out that the manna was physical, and it was given to a physical people, and that those physical people who ate the manna died. Again, we rehearsed all of this on Passover to some degree, but can we learn anything from the example of the manna that God gave to Israel back when he brought them out of Egypt? Now, I believe we can, and I believe Jesus was specifically indicating that here. So let's refer back to the first time that manna is mentioned. If we go back to Exodus chapter 16. Exodus chapter 16, and we'll start in verse 1. And it says, "And they," Israel, "journeyed from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month, after they departed from the land of Egypt. Then the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said to them, 'Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, and when we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger.'" So this event, it says it's on the 15th day of the second month, is about 1 month after the Israelites left Egypt. Now, I want to point out there's another scripture in the Bible that says that this journey, if it was a single person, should have taken about 11 days. So we're at a month. And I don't believe that the Israelites thought that the journey was going to take that long. Now, of course, with a large group, there was probably about 2 million of them, it would have taken longer. So they would have anticipated, you know, some length of time. But it's clear at this point that whatever provisions that the Israelites had brought along were not enough to get past a month. They were out of food. They were in a desert, and they were out of food, and there are 2 million of them. And it was not unlogical for them to say, "What's going to happen to us?" Now, the complaining, they obviously had no faith that God was going to take care of them, but they were pretty sure they were going to die at this point. There didn't seem to be, at least physically speaking, there didn't seem to be any answer to this problem. I know I've gone camping in the past. I'd go up to on the 4th of July, my family used to go up into the Little Grand Canyon, and we would hike back 5 miles, and we would pack all the food that we were going to eat for 5 miles. And that was for, we would normally go for 3 days, maybe 5 days tops. And I tell you, that bag with food for 5 days was heavy. Now, maybe I ate a lot as a teenager, and I didn't carry the most efficiently, you know, light stuff. But you run out of stuff pretty quick. They were carrying everything that they owned. Now, they were slaves, so they probably didn't own a whole lot. But if you were going to carry all the food that you were going to be able to have, how much are you going to be able to take? And God wasn't in a hurry. They were following the cloud. So they had gotten as far as they got because the cloud had gotten that far. You know, God knew what he was going to do here. They didn't. So let's turn to verse 4, and it says, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not. You know, God makes very clear, it doesn't say that Moses even went to God on this. God knew that the need was there, and God said, you know, I have a plan for this. I'm going to rain bread from heaven. You didn't see that coming, did you, Moses? Israel, you didn't see it coming. But I'm going to do that, and not only am I going to do that, this is going to be a test in whether you obey me or not. So, in verse 5 it says, and it shall be on the sixth day that they shall prepare what they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gathered daily. You know, one of the specific instructions that he's making and performing here with this miracle of providing manna is that he was providing a very visible demonstration of the Sabbath being important to him. On the sixth day, the miracle was going to be different than every other day. They were going to get twice as much, specifically so that, you know, they wouldn't have to go out and collect it on the Sabbath. Let's drop down to verse 12. God says, I have heard the murmurings of the children of Israel. Speak to them, saying, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God. And we'll skip down to verse 14. And when the layer of dew lifted, there on the surface of the wilderness was a small round substance, as fine as frost on the ground. So when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, this is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. This is the thing which the Lord has commanded. Let every man gather it according to each one's need. One omer for each person, according to the number of persons. Let every man take for those who are in his tent. And the children of Israel did so and gathered, some more, some less. So when they measured it by omers, he who gathered much had nothing over, and he who gathered little had no lack. Every man had gathered according to each one's need. So God provided the manna. It was a tiny little round thing. It says it looked like frost. And people weren't sure what to make of it. But they were each supposed to collect an omer. And the manna was given out freely, but they were each supposed to collect only an omer. And it says, you know, if they got too much, then they'd, you know, they only kept an omer of it. You couldn't accumulate this. God was saying you were supposed to do it every day. You couldn't become wealthy in manna. Although we will see that some of them attempted it. But I think he had some lessons for us in that. But it had to be gathered, and it had to be gathered each day. We go to verse 19. And Moses said, let no one leave any of it till morning. Notwithstanding, they did not heed Moses. But some of them left part of it until morning, and it bred worms and stank, and Moses was angry with them. So they gathered it every morning, every man according to his need, and when the sun became hot, it melted. You know, one of God's instructions, he did say he was going to test them, whether they were going to obey him or not. One of his instructions was that it was supposed to be collected each day and used up each day. Like I said, you couldn't become rich in manna. And some of them did not obey that. Now, I'm guessing this only happened once, because some of them tried to keep some for the next day. And everybody around them knew it, because if they kept any for the next day, it bred worms and it stank. And I am sure that anybody who went past that tent was like, They didn't get rid of their manna. They knew what was going on. So I'm imagining that probably only happened the first time. But they didn't listen. God gave them some pretty clear instructions, and it seems pretty simple, but they didn't listen. We'll read on in verse 22. And so it was on the sixth day that they gathered twice as much bread, two omers for each one, and all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses. Then he said to them, this is what the Lord has said. Tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you bake today and boil what you boil and lay up for yourselves all that remains to be kept until morning. So they laid it up till morning, as Moses commanded, and it did not stink, nor were there any worms in it. Then Moses said, "Eat that today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, there will be none." Now it happened that some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather, but they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, "How long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, for the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, he gives you on the sixth day bread for 2 days. Let every man remain in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day." So the people rested on the seventh day. You know, God also used manna as an instruction on how to keep the Sabbath. In Egypt, they were slaves. You know, they were not keeping the Sabbath. Now, again, some of the people didn't follow the instruction. Pretty clear instructions. And I don't know what was going through their head. God said, you know, collect two today. Maybe they thought, "Oh, I got burned last time. I didn't listen. And that turned into worms. I'm making sure I only get one. I don't want worms again." It's possible. But some of the people did not follow the instruction, and God was very angry. Again, I'm guessing that only happened once. You go hungry once, and you're going to learn, next week I'm going to, on that sixth day, when everybody gets two, I'm going to get two for myself. But God was conditioning Israel to keep his Sabbath by the giving of manna. You know, they had a very physical demonstration that God was treating this one day very, very differently than any of the other days. That he was setting it apart. They couldn't deny that at all. So for 40 years, from this point on, they get manna every day except for the Sabbath. That's 40 years of conditioning to keep the Sabbath. It's 40 years of conditioning of seeing a miracle every day that God's providing. Let's read a couple last verses. In verse 31, it says, "And the house of Israel called its name Manna," which means, "What's it?" "And it was like white coriander seed, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. Then Moses said, 'This is the thing which the Lord has commanded. Fill an omer with it to be kept for your generations, that they may see the bread with which I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt.' And Moses said to Aaron, 'Take a pot and put an omer of manna in it and lay it up before the Lord to be kept for your generations.'" You know, it's very interesting that God instructs Moses to put an omer of manna in the Ark of Covenant. There's only three things in that ark. There's the Ten Commandments on the stones. There's the rod of Aaron that budded. And then there's a pot of manna. I found that interesting. Now let's unwrap a few of the lessons that God was providing. You know, first I want to state that I think we all understand the symbology of Israel coming out of Egypt being a parallel to us coming out of sin. I think we could make the argument that their 40-year journey to the promised land is a parallel in our Christian lives, that until death or Jesus returns, you know, we're on that journey as well. The promised land was the goal. And I think the 7 days of the days of unleavened bread is representative of this as well. You know, 7 days is a number, seven is a number of completeness. God was pointing out that, you know, for 7 days you need to live this unleavened life. As a representative, we need to live that way to the very end. Now, if we consider this, the first and most important lesson that we can come away with was that God's provision of manna was a lifesaver to the Israelites, and that Jesus is our lifesaver. You know, this was a group of probably 2 million people wandering around in the desert that had run out of food. They were all going to die of hunger unless God provided the manna. That's That is the simple reality of it. They weren't going to survive. If there's no manna, there is no Israel. In the same way, if there's no Jesus, there's no humanity long term. We're dead. Let's turn back to John chapter 1. John chapter 1, we'll read verses 1 through 4. It says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through Him, and without Him nothing was made that was made. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. Now, Jesus is our life. He created us. He watched us mess up. He sacrificed Himself to redeem us, and without Him living in us, we have no life. Let's turn back to John chapter 5, verse 21. We'll read verses 21 through 27. It says, for as the Father raises the dead and gives life to them, even so the Son gives life to whom He will. For the Father judges no one, but has committed all judgment to the Son, that all should honor the Son just as they honor the Father. He who does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent Him. Most assuredly, I say to you, he who hears My word and believes in Him who sent Me has everlasting life and shall not come into judgment, but is passed from death into life. Most assuredly, I say to you, the hour is coming, and now is, when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. For as the Father has life in Himself, so He has granted the Son to have life in Himself, and has given Him authority to execute judgment also, because He is the Son of Man. One final scripture just on the next page, John chapter 6, verse 27. This is Jesus speaking, and He says, do not labor for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to everlasting life, which the Son of Man will give you, because God the Father has set His seal on Him. We've read that in the past, but it strikes home the point. Jesus is the source of our life. If we don't partake of His flesh, His sacrifice, then we have no life. We have no hope for life. We're dead. And it's only through His sacrificed flesh and blood that He shed that we have life. We are continually dependent upon Jesus, just as Israel was continually dependent on manna to keep alive, the manna from God. Now, also consider that God was teaching Israel about Himself. You know, Israel had probably a very warped concept of what God was. They lived in Egypt. They would have absorbed what the Egyptians believed. If you look at the 10 plagues that God sent on Egypt, I mean, I think a lot of that was instruction for Israelis too, because each of the plagues was targeted against a god in Egypt. He was proving to the Israelites that these gods that they saw being worshipped all the time and possibly were involved in worshipping were nothing, that He was more powerful than them. But God, in this example, is showing a different part of His greatness. You know, those other gods couldn't protect the Egyptians. They couldn't do anything for the Egyptians. But God was providing manna. He was providing bread. He was providing life for them in a desert. Enough manna was provided to feed a group of millions. I don't think we can fully conceive of how much manna had to have actually been there for every one of them to get an omerful. It would have been a lot of manna. And it was so perfectly distributed, each person got one jar of manna, that it proved that God knew exactly how many people He was providing for. He basically was showing them that their most basic need, He knew that they existed as an individual, and that he could provide for their specific individual need. And further, he even made it taste good. He didn't have to do that. You know, it says that it tasted like honey with wafers. Now, he could have made it very bland. He could have said, he could have done whatever he wanted, but he made it taste good. That says something about God. It says that he wants to give good things. I think we know scriptures that basically say that as well, that he wants good things for all of us, for all of his children. You know, next, as manna was given to prove the Israelites, Jesus proves us as well. Let's turn back to Luke chapter 6. We're going to read verses 46 through 49. Jesus says, "But why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do the things which I say? Whoever comes to me and hears my saying and does them, I will show you whom he is like. He is like a man building a house who dug deep and laid the foundation on the rock. And when the flood arose, the stream beat vehemently against that house and could not shake it, for it was founded on the rock. But he who heard and did nothing is like a man who built a house on the earth without foundation, against which the stream beat vehemently, and immediately it fell. And the ruin of that house was great." You know, Jesus has given us many instructions. Keep in mind, Jesus is the God of the Old Testament. So he gave us instructions from back then. But then he further expounded upon them and indicated that God looks to the spirit of the command and not just the letter. And he's basically saying here, you know, if you don't do the things that I do, it doesn't matter if you say, "Lord, Lord." Your house, when the storm comes, your house is going to fall. And the ruin will be great. Let's turn back to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5, verse 16. We'll start in verse 16. We'll read through 28. It says, "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." So right off the bat, Jesus is saying there need to be works. Those works are not going to save you. I'm going to save you. Jesus will save you. But he expects works. "Do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For assuredly, I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, not one jot or tittle will by any means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. Whoever, therefore, breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." And that message there was hard for people to understand because the scribes and the Pharisees, they knew the law very, very well. They knew the letter of the law. And they kept the letter of the law about as perfectly as a human being can. And Jesus is saying, if you keep the commandments like them, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. So he goes on to explain, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder,' and whoever murders will be in danger of judgment. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, 'Fool,' shall be in danger of the council. But you, whoever says," and that word back there said raka, which my thing said fool. "But whoever says, 'You fool,' shall be in danger of hellfire. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. First, be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. Agree with your adversary quickly while you are on the way with him, lest your adversary deliver you to the judge hand you over to the officer, and you be thrown into prison. Assuredly, I say to you, you will by no means get out of there till you have paid the last penny. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So Jesus is basically saying, I'm expanding the law to get to the heart of the matter, to get to your heart. It's not enough to not kill somebody. You have to get rid of hatred. That's a much more difficult thing to do. And we can't do it on our own. We can only do it if he's living in us. He's saying, you've heard not to commit adultery. I'm saying, don't even look. Again, it's a difficult thing to do. And it can only be done if he's living in us. He was expanding the law. He has expectations. Him coming and being in us means that the expectations are set higher for us now. He has expectations. He knows each one of us. He knows what we're doing, and he knows what sacrifice we've taken. His sacrifice. Now, by taking the manna, God also was conditioning Israel to obey his Sabbath. And by partaking of our Savior, we are also being conditioned to becoming like him. You know, we rehearse this lesson each year as we take the Passover. But even more, this should be a continual daily part of our lives. The manna came to them every day. By providing the manna each day, God was every day providing a miracle and a witness of his care of Israel. They had to be reflecting on that as they were collecting the manna. It's interesting to notice they had to collect it in the morning as well, because by noon it melted. You know, do we reflect on Jesus' sacrifice every day? We should. Is it the way we begin our days? You know, we need to take time each day to reflect on the miracles that God performs in our lives, and specifically on the miracle of redemption that Jesus' sacrifice provides for us. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 4. We'll read verses 2 through 4. It says, and when he had fasted 40 days, Jesus, and 40 nights, afterwards he was hungry. Now then, the tempter came to him and said, if you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread. But he answered and said, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. You know, we need to consider that. Every word that proceeds from the mouth of God is spiritual food. It's spiritual food for us. We need to partake of it. This book, the Bible, it's the words of God. That's part of our spiritual food. It's not all of it, but it's part of it. Just turn back to John chapter 4. It tells us some more. John chapter 4 and verse 32. We'll read through verse 34. But he, being Jesus, said to them, I have food to eat which you do not know. Therefore the disciples said to one another, hey, has anybody brought him anything to eat? But Jesus said to them, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work. You know, doing God's will is spiritual food. It's spiritual food to Jesus. It can be spiritual food to us. We need to be reflecting on what he wants us to do. We need to be reflecting on how we can better serve him, how we can better serve each other. Those things can be spiritual food. So as manna was taken every day, we need to reflect on what God's done for us, and we need to reflect on the spiritual food that he provides for us and partake of it. Another lesson we can learn is that manna was given freely to everyone by God. So also, the life that Jesus is offering is a gift to us. None of us can earn it. None of the Israelites earned any manna. It was given to them. It was a gift. I think we know this, but turn quickly back to Ephesians chapter 2. We'll read verses 8 through 10. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It is the gift of God, not of works, lest anyone should boast. For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. You know, we were under the death penalty. Every person in here has sinned. We've all been under the death penalty. Nothing we could do would or will ever save us. Only Jesus' sacrifice can do that. Now note again, when he states that, that just because our works can't save us, doesn't mean that God doesn't want us to walk in good works. He says that we were made to walk in good works as his workmanship, as we're becoming more like him. That's the least we can do, considering the greatness of the gift that we've been offered. You know, Israel was offered a promised land. And the land of Israel, you know, there's a lot of good things that grow over there. There's a lot of food. I mean, when the spies went in and they came back with the fruit, it was a good land. But we're being offered something so much better, a much better promise, eternal life, a spirit body, a place in his kingdom, and a close relationship with each other and with Jesus and the Father himself. One final scripture. Let's turn back to Joshua chapter 5. Joshua chapter 5, starting in verse 10. And this is as the children of Israel go into the promised land. So the children of Israel camped in Gilgal and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight on the plains of Jericho. And they ate of the produce of the land on the day after the Passover, unleavened bread and parched grain on the very same day. Now the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten the produce of the land, and the children of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate the food of the land of Canaan that year. You know, it's interesting that the manna stopped during the first days of unleavened bread in the promised land. You know, God had fulfilled his promise, as he always does. He had gotten them there. We can see how trustworthy a God we serve. They could see how trustworthy a God they had served. He had gotten them to where he said he was going to get them. So as we keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread, let's reflect on the bread. Our bread isn't physical manna from heaven. No, we have an even better bread offered to us and for us. The true bread from heaven, Jesus, the anointed of God, which we may partake of and not die, for he is life.